Today, we look back at the Great Recession of 2008 and how it affected community banks. I'm so glad you could join me for my conversation with Roger Beveridge, CEO and President of the Oklahoma Bankers Association. I am Honey Shelton, and this is Training Matters.
Training Matters is brought to you by the Training Institute, dedicated to setting the standard for individuals responsible for training effectiveness in banks and credit unions across the country.
Today, my guest is Roger Beveridge. Roger is a client, a friend, and a dedicated advocate for community banks. He's calling in from his office at the Oklahoma Bankers Association in Oklahoma City. As president and CEO, what does your role at the Oklahoma Bankers Association entail, Roger?
Honey, we do a number of things here at the association. We're about 120 years old. We've been around Oklahoma, principally being the advocate for the banking industry. What that means is that we lobby for legislation that at the state and federal level that will help bankers better be able to serve their customers, and we try to oppose or kill legislation or ideas that we believe will be harmful to banks, particularly in their ability to serve their customers and communities. We've done that, and we've been fairly successful at it at the state level. The federal level is an entirely different matter. One of the other things that we do education and training, and thank the Lord for your participation and help with that. I don't know how many thousands of tellers and others that you've taught and brought along here in Oklahoma, but I know it's a vast amount. And that's what we do as a part of our education and training membership feature. We try to help bankers be better at what they do every day by keeping them up to date and having sessions on new issues that have just come up, and boy, there have been plenty of those since 2010. We also provide a service that provides for bankers at no cost legal and compliance services. That need has grown exponentially in the last 6 years, and what we have to offer are two full-time attorneys who are banking-specific experts, as well as four compliance officers who are banking-specific experts, former bankers and now turned compliance gurus who help bankers here answer questions about rules and regulations that they have to comply with on a daily basis. And again, that's at no charge. We also have a fraud division, honey. We're the only association in the country that has a fraud division, and what it does is it tries to help banks and their employees, and most importantly, their customers, understand the nature of the frauds that are going on out there, how it impacts both the bank and the customer. And sometimes it's difficult to explain to bank customers that they really didn't win the Canadian lottery and that armored truck is not going to show up at midnight, so do not send somebody in Nigeria money. Little things like that have gone a long way in helping Oklahoma customers of banks save literally millions of dollars over the last 10 years. Our fraud division has exceeded my expectations in terms of the service that we can provide to banks and especially to their customers. We also do public relations. We try to tell the good news of banking, which has been a challenge since 2008, but we try to put forth the best stories that we can that demonstrate what community banking is all about and why it's so critically important to Oklahoma consumers. And last, we do offer some products and services to our banks, like insurance for their operation and for the buildings and the properties that they own, things like that. So overall, that's our package of offerings, our benefits, if you will, to member banks. And we represent about 98% of the banks in Oklahoma, and probably 98.5% of the total assets here.
No doubt about it. The association is fighting hard for the community bank and to help the consumer, and your members are some of the finest that I've ever met, and I do love my association with OBA. You brought up 2008. That's a tender spot for a lot of us. Let's go back a little bit in time and tell our listeners what happened and what's been the fallout of 2008 for the community bank.
The Great Recession that started with the near collapse of the nation's financial system was really brought about by a federal policy of trying to drive home ownership to more Americans without really taking into consideration the basic question involved in banking, which is, if I lend you this money, can you repay it? We had many innovations, if you will, that were utilized by a lot of investment firms and some of the larger Wall Street banks and investment houses that really were more interested in increasing the transaction numbers where they gained fees rather than looking at the underlying criteria of the securities that they were hoisting off on the federal government and the general public. And it was, in my view, more like a Ponzi scheme that ultimately collapsed. And we lost a number of large firms, Bear Stearns and some of the others. And, of course, that forced reaction by Congress. And the first thing they did was put out a bailout. It was what it's been called, of about $700 billion. Not all of that went to the banks, by the way, and what did go to the banks has been repaid with interest, so it's not like it was a giveaway. But the other thing that the situation in 2008 did is it brought about a law that we refer to as Dodd-Frank. It was an effort and an attempt by Congress to fix the problems that had led to the near collapse of the financial system. Now, that having been said, the role that community banks brought to the table at this point in terms of enhancing or increasing the problem that was created was zero for the most part. In other words, community banks had nothing to do with the underwriting of securities backed by real estate mortgages. They went on about their business of financing their local customers and their local communities. But when Dodd-Frank finally was agreed to, passed, and signed into law, and I don't think there were more than a couple or three Republicans that voted for it, that law, it's 2,719 pages in length, and it will generate more than 20,000 pages of rules and regulations that will apply to banks of all sizes, regardless of whether they had anything to do with the causes of the crisis. And that, I suspect, has been the most dramatic change that has happened just in the last several years. It has imposed on smaller community banks a tremendous regulatory responsibility and cost that they are having difficulty with in terms of utilizing resources. And why that's important to consumers is because for every rule or regulation that comes out of Washington, there is an element of complexity and cost. It takes time to make sure the bank is doing what the rule or the regulation requires. And that is time that's taken away from the bank's primary mission, which is to make loans to consumers and enhance the community in which the bank does business. That's the whole point of banking, and it has been historically. I suspect that it is something that most citizens don't understand, and I get that. They don't live in the environment that Dodd-Frank has created. But this is an example of what has gone on in terms of forcing all banks, regardless of size or business model, to be subjected to the same rule and regulation. And I think consumers know instinctively that that doesn't make any sense. There are no two banks alike. There are no two bank customers that are alike. Yet Congress has dictated that banks generally are bad and that they will all be swept under this umbrella of we're going to resolve the bad. Let me give you an example of how it impacts consumers. For a long time, the ability of a consumer to go to a community bank and get a mortgage loan was a fairly simple process. They went in, made an application, filled out a few pages, and the bank judged the question of whether they would repay the loan, concluded they would, made the loan, took the mortgage back on the home and kept it as security, and everybody was happy, and it worked. It worked great. Unfortunately, the federal government, in the name of trying to help consumers better understand the nature of their mortgage process, has added untold documents, disclosures, and other instruments that accompany any closing on any home mortgage. Pages and pages and pages of stuff that virtually no consumer, no borrower either reads or cares about. Essentially, they want to know two things. One, can I get the loan? And number two, what is my monthly payment? The rest of it is normally something that the bank and the consumers have always agreed on, and it's never been a problem. But particularly in the wake of 2008 activities and the Dodd-Frank Act that was passed in 2010, the government has increased the number of pages and documents that are required in assigning. And most importantly, they have laid out the circumstances or the criteria for a consumer to have before he or she can qualify for a mortgage. Now, I know that's a long story about how we got to this point, but let me show you what I'm talking about in terms of how it impacts Roger Beveridge as a consumer. This is a real example, not me specifically, but a bank customer had a mortgage loan like the one I described, and it was with a local bank, and it had worked. She was a single mom. She had never missed a payment. In fact, she had never been late on her payments. She applied for a new mortgage in 2012, I believe, to try and take advantage of the lowering of interest rates, and Trump wanted to refinance her mortgage, which hundreds and thousands of consumers did. Under the new rules, she didn't qualify for the mortgage. Now, think about that for a minute. She had a mortgage with this bank. She had never missed a payment. She hadn't even been late on the payments. She's refinancing her house in an effort to give her better cash flow control. And she doesn't meet the new qualifications that the government has said must be met before she has qualified for the mortgage. Now, that's just insane, it seems to me. And it is nothing more than the government trying to dictate the circumstances under which consumers will be allowed to have the privilege to access credit. And that's none of their business. What is their business is to make sure that the institution is operated in a safe and sound manner. And that is a totally separate function from dictating how consumers must stack up according to some specific general rules that have to apply to everybody end up having a lot of consumers disappointed. And from the banker's perspective, who does the consumer blame for not being able to get to the loan? They blame the bank. And it's not the bank. It's the process that's changed. It's the requirements that have been established by the government that have changed. And that has driven a lot of consumers to what I call the shadow banking system. And that is people that operate financial companies of some form outside of the regulatory environment that deals with and covers all commercial banks in the country. You hear them advertised all the time on radio, for example, and I don't know whether that's good or bad, but what I do know is that the rules and the changes that have been directed at all banks and which treat all banks the same are destroying the community bank model and how it has operated for generations, not just in Oklahoma, but in the country. To me, that is something that is not acceptable. It simply ignores reality, and we're going to do everything we can to try and change it.
Well, Roger, I can so appreciate what you're talking about. We bought a house in December, and the closing, the amount of paper was just as you described it, as well as an arduous process for everyone involved.
Does your company have job openings? Finding the right people for your bank or credit union can be hard. If you are looking for qualified professionals, use our job board to reach ideal candidates from your industry. Go to interaction-training.com/jobs to get started. Help us spread the word. It's free. Each day, our site is visited by hundreds of bankers, branch personnel, credit union leaders, compliance specialists, HR professionals, trainers, and tellers. There's a good chance they're exactly who you are looking for. Get busy. Post every position you are looking for on our website, interaction-training.com/jobs. Find who you are looking for and find them for free.
A couple of things that come to mind in listening to you recount what happened and how it has affected the bank, the consumer, the community. I think I'd like to hear you talk about, one, what do you mean by a community bank, so that we're positive our listeners are on the same page? And then another piece of that, you know, I started my company in 1983, shortly thereafter had the great privilege of starting to work for Oklahoma Bankers Association and many others. And there were around 14,000 banks. And today, if I'm right about what's on the roll at the FDIC, I believe it's at least half of that. So can you talk about the definition of a community bank and what's happened to the numbers?
A community bank is one that operates based on its relationships with its customers. In other words, it doesn't evaluate customers simply on the numbers they provide. It's not a transaction-based business. Community banks are in the business of helping consumers catch their dreams. That's what they do every day. And that dream may be building or buying a home. It may be educating a child. Perhaps it's simply starting a new business or trying to enhance an existing business. But for whatever reason, community banks and their basic relationship model of serving consumers is what takes care of those needs for capital to finance the consumer's dream. And when everything clicks together, as it should and as we expect it will whenever a loan is made, then all three entities involved in that loan succeed. Certainly the bank succeeds because the loan is repaid with interest and it generates a profit for its shareholders. The consumer is benefited because he or she has been able to achieve their dream, whatever that might be. And particularly in the case of small businesses, the community itself, in which both the bank operates and the consumer lives, has benefited because of added jobs or more capital and more capital flow within the community, which has helped it grow. Over the years, there have been efforts made, I think, to drive more banks to the transaction-based model, if you will. It's not so much a matter of size, which a lot of people in Washington want to make it. They want to say, well, a bank that's $10 billion in total assets or less is a community bank. Well, it might be, but it might not be, too. It might not operate the way that a traditional community bank does. And a bank that's, say, $15 billion in total assets, maybe over the $10 billion artificial ceiling, but it still operates based on its practice of focusing on the consumer and the relationship that's built and maintained over time. That's the difference between a big, large transaction-based firm and one that's based on its relationship with its customers. That's what they want to grow, and they want to continue as the banks continue to perform. Now, you asked about or talked about changes that I've seen over the course of my career. In 1985, I was a state banking regulator in another state. At that time, there were approximately 14,357 FDIC-insured commercial banks in the country. In Oklahoma, there were a little over 500 commercial banks, and there were 500 banking locations in the state at that time. Over the course of the last 30 years, that number has dropped considerably, so that in December of last year, there were about 5,338 commercial banks and 844 what I call thrifts. They're savings banks or savings and loan associations, but they're all FDIC insured, and that total is 6,182 FDIC insured institutions. So that's more than half. That's probably a 60% drop in the sheer number of bank charters in this country. And most of it has come about because banks have exited the business through mergers or consolidations or even failures. And I think over the last 30 years, about 17% of the banks in that number that have gone away over that same period went away because they collapsed or they failed. The impact has been felt most in small communities and smaller banks that are under, say, $100 million in total assets. But here's the interesting part, at least I think it is, and there are a lot fewer charters and a lot fewer banks, but there are a whole lot more locations because of the changes that have been made in branching laws that have come about over the last 30 years. And in Oklahoma, I mentioned that there were about 500 locations because there was one charter and one location that was permitted. Today, a bank can go anywhere in Oklahoma and establish a branch if they want to. And we have about 210 bank charters. Well, we have almost 1,500 locations where banks are located in big cities and smaller towns and so on and so forth. Another thing that's happened, honey, is that over that same course of time, banks have gotten larger. The country has grown. The assets of banks generally have grown from roughly $3.75 trillion in 1985 to almost $15 trillion today. And the irony of the Dodd-Frank Act that I talked about earlier is that one of the things it was intended to do was end the concept of too big to fail. A bank simply was too important systemically to be closed, and therefore its actions didn't have to be held to the same standards that, say, smaller banks were subjected to. The irony is that since 2010, the big banks have gotten larger and the small banks have continued to dwindle in numbers. And just for the record, Dodd-Frank did not end too big to fail. It institutionalized it. And it is one of the worst pieces of legislation I've ever seen, and I've been around this business for a very long time.
Well, Roger, those numbers are staggering when you think about the number of banks in the early 80s and where we are now, and of course the impact of branching. Talking about Dodd-Frank, talking about the government, talking about what has happened, when you look forward, thinking about regulatory impact, compliance concerns, the political environment, what do you see coming up?
Well, not much that's good, unfortunately. Let me try and answer that question this way. What I hope your listeners, that consumers will understand, is that all banks understand and expect and know that they're going to be regulated in terms of operating a bank in a safe and sound manner. Every banker who has ever lived knows that regulations are critically important to their continued operation. But what's happened, particularly since 2010, is that the rules and regulations have grown exponentially to where one of the most important elements of a bank examination, a banking regulator, is to examine the bank's compliance function rather than the strength of the credits, the loans, that it has in its note case. And it seems to me that that is just ridiculous. As I said earlier, every rule or regulation comes with a cost of complexity and compliance itself. A compliance officer doesn't generate a nickel's worth of income for the bank. That compliance officer is simply there to make sure that the bank follows all of the rules and regulations that are imposed on the banking industry. And that requirement falls disproportionately on smaller banks because they don't have the big number of employees. Larger banks can have, and one has like 25,000 compliance lawyers. Well, how do you explain that to a bank in, say, Nash, Oklahoma, that's $15 million in total assets and has 3.5 employees and still has to do the same thing that that large bank with 25,000 compliance lawyers has to do? Is there something wrong with that picture? My answer is yes. And that's all because of the political environment that has engulfed the banking industry and in which we seem to be stuck with no exit in sight. And when I look forward to the election this year and what Congress is going to look like over the next 4 to 8 years, I don't see much good coming out for the banking industry. There is a passion, I think, in Washington that simply has fed the anger at particularly large banks. You hear it from Senator Sanders during the campaign that he's been making about how he's going to break up the big banks. And he and others bash the banking industry. And I just want to scream at him and say, stop doing that. It's not the industry. Banks are not all alike, and community banks are not who you're talking about. But consumers don't hear that. They hear just bank, and they assume it's everybody. It's every bank, and it isn't. And that's what I dislike about it. When we go to Washington and talk to our representatives, our senators, and even senators and representatives from other states, we have consistently, for the last 6 years, right up until today, expressed the view that We understand the need for rules and regulations. We get that. We're not asking for exemption from all of the rules that have been accumulated up to 2010. But the rest of this stuff that's grown and has impacted community banks is ridiculous. What it does is add costs to the bank's operation, and it takes time away from the bank's principal mission, which is to take care of its customers. To me, nothing good is going to come out of an enhanced regulatory environment that tries to restrict the ability of consumers to get access to credit or capital. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. And in part, it's a reflection, I think, of at least some of us, community banks and some of their customers. It's a reflection of the anger that a lot of people are feeling and that can best be seen in the candidacy of Donald Trump. I mean, the people that are his supporters are justifiably angry. They're angry at the system, and they want somebody who's willing to go to Washington and take it on. And I admire Mr. Trump's willingness to want to take it on. I'm not sure that I agree with most of his ideas about how to do that, but somebody needs to. I don't think there's any question in the mind of anybody who's familiar with it. Honey, the process is broken. The process has been broken for years, and it continues to operate on the same principle that the most important question to me as a senator or a representative, and this is generic now, the most important question is not whether I can do something to help the bankers or the bank customers or the communities in which they live. The most important question to me is, what do I have to do to get reelected? And that's not the purpose. That's not the point. Mm-hmm. The point is, you're sent there in a representative government to take care of and to help your constituents, your customers, your consumers back home. The process is broken, in my opinion. It doesn't work that way anymore. Republicans don't talk to Democrats. Democrats don't talk to Republicans. There's no sense of compromise. And when you approach a senator or a representative about an idea, an amendment, a specific bill to relieve some of the regulatory requirements on smaller banks that are nonsensical and that are intended for large Wall Street firms, when you approach someone, whether a Republican or a Democrat, it doesn't really matter. Their reaction to it is based on the political fallout that will come about if they support or oppose. And just to give you an example, we had a bill recently in the House Financial Services Committee. And what it says is that going forward, federal banking regulators will be given the authority to judge whether a specific rule or regulation should apply to a bank based on its operating model and its risk profile. Seems to me that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Most of the Democrats, all but three of them, in fact, on the committee voted no. And the argument that was made by the minority leader on the committee was that this bill will undermine Dodd-Frank. And that's just hogwash. It has nothing to do with Dodd-Frank. And yet, that's what happens when you get into a situation like that. We can't do anything to unwind Dodd-Frank if we're Democrats, because that will cost us votes back home. And that's the kind of thing, to me, that I think most consumers need to understand. Understand what's happening as it is, not as you think it is or as it's reported in the media. And that, I know, takes a little work, but it still has to be done.
Well, Roger, I think we all, including the consumer, has a wide array of frustration and confusion. And many of us grit our teeth when we listen to the news and they talk about banks like it's one big industry that created some of the mess that Dodd-Frank claims must be in place today to prevent it again. This has been So enlightening. I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to share with our audience what's going on in banking, especially when we talk about the community bank and all the good that's going on at the Oklahoma Bankers Association. I sure will look forward to the next time I see you in Oklahoma City, and I know our listeners will find what you shared with them highly valuable.
Well, I hope so. Honey, you're the best, and I appreciate the opportunity to be with you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Training Matters with Honey Shelton.